Live from Washington, Florida, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Tom Tryon, Frank Alcock, Susan Nyland, Eric Hodges, Judy Sedgman, and Sherrod Halliburton and Robin DiSabatino. Our program tonight coming to you from the studios of METV. That's the educational station in Manatee County, Florida. Nice to have you with us this evening. There will be no phone calls tonight. However, we'll be taking questions via email at brucedumont@museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's @Dumo. And, of course, you can join the program on the World Wide Web at beyondthebeltway.com. There are now just 22 days to go before the important Florida primary, as well as primaries in Illinois, Ohio, Missouri, and North Carolina, and there are 260 days to go before Election Day. Yesterday, of course, there was big news coming out of Nevada, which we'll talk about in the second hour, but in the South Carolina primary, Donald Trump, as expected, finishing in first place, 32.5%. Marco Rubio narrowly in second place, 22.5%, and closely behind Ted Cruz, 22.5%. The difference between Rubio and Cruz was about 1,100 votes. And again, Jeb Bush, the governor, former governor of Florida, finished in fourth place with 8%, as well as the Ohio governor, John Kasich, and Ben Carson finished with 7%. Immediately after the results became apparent last night, Jeb Bush surprised people with his concession speech by announcing that he was going to suspend his campaign. And again, it thrusts Florida and what happens in Florida so much into the focus of what happens in campaign 2016. And we've got great panelists to talk about. Tom Tryon is with the Herald Tribune editorial board opinion editor of it. What is the big story for you coming out of the results in South Carolina last night?
All right. Thank you very much. First, welcome to the county where I was born and raised, Manatee County. So good to have you here. For me, it's obviously it's Trump hanging on, but I think as a Floridian, somebody who watched Jeb Bush campaign three times for governor, it's his demise as a presidential candidate for a couple reasons. One, he obviously was the front runner going into it. He raised a lot of money. He had the Bush name. But I think two things happened. One, he did not deliver, obviously. And the second thing is the party has gone so far to the right of him. That he is no longer a standard bearer for the Republican Party.
Susan Nyland, how do you analyze what happened yesterday in South Carolina?
You know, I concur with Tom. I think it was actually a real big surprise for me that Jeb stepped out, even though the writing was on the wall. I thought he would at least hang in until Florida just because he had Florida to pull from. That being said, I do agree his campaign has been milquetoast the entire time without a whole lot of oomph. I think it started spiraling downward the minute the first Republican debate where Jeb was right next to Trump, and Trump just overshadowed him, and he was never able to gain ground.
Frank Alcock also joins us. He is with New College of Florida. Does Trump have this locked up?
Nobody has it locked up yet. I think yesterday for me, the writing was on the wall for former Governor Bush, and so it was just a matter of time, I think, before he got out. So even though it's dramatic, it might have surprised a few people, but we all knew that was coming. I think that for me, the most interesting thing that happened yesterday, the most salient thing was Rubio nipping Ted Cruz. I think Ted Cruz shouldn't have finished in third, and even though it was very
close. Of the evangelical vote?
Yeah. I mean, I think if he loses to Marco Rubio, even by a close amount, in South Carolina, and Trump beats him thoroughly and he finishes third, what does that say about these SEC primaries that are coming up, where I thought if you went back a month ago that he probably would have an extremely strong showing on the SEC primaries. Now that's questionable. I think Trump might beat him in a lot of places.
How big is the evangelical vote in Florida?
In terms of the size, maybe you can help me out on that one. I don't think it's certainly as – in the other SEC states, it's not as big in this state. We're a very big, broad, diverse state. It's significant, correct, but it's not that huge.
Tom, a surprise for me is that it didn't surprise me that Rubio finished second. It surprised that it was so narrow, given the fact that he had the endorsement of Nikki Haley, of Trey Gowdy, and also of Senator Scott. I mean, he had the big three political operatives in the state, excluding Lindsey Graham, and it got him to second place, clearly, but it was a narrow second place.
Sure, and I think one thing we have to talk about is, you know, all the rules are out the window. The old rules of getting endorsements, getting newspaper endorsements, getting the endorsements of candidates, you know, people in office. That just isn't doing the thing in this campaign.
Just throw conventional wisdom to the side.
I mean, it's throwing conventional wisdom is trite. It's a trite phrase, but in this case, it's on target.
I think getting off up the floor, at least the media put him on the floor, and that's Trump. Trump's performance in the South Carolina. I said this last Sunday night. I couldn't believe that, you know, the statements he made about George Bush and about the war, and there are Republicans who don't support the war in Iraq. But to go to the next step and to say that George Bush lied about I just thought, oh, my God, he was committing political suicide right in front of a national audience. But it didn't happen that way.
Correct, except that it's Trump. And that's why he's been able to break every single rule. However, I would like to point out, though, that with the people that are actually dropping out of the Republican campaign, you would think that Trump numbers would go up, and they're not. They're staying exactly where it is. Whose numbers are going up are actually Rubio's. And that, I think, is a significant difference. We're still at the beginning of the primary right now. I think there's many states to go. And as more people drop out, I think other candidates are going to get stronger.
Well, also, given the venom that has gone back and forth between Trump and Cruz, you know, who a month ago they were bros, they were on the same team basically.
I thought they were in cahoots.
They were in cahoots for it looked like they were in cahoots for a while. But again, that is, I can't see too many Ted Cruz voters going to Donald Trump. I mean, they may be as locked in with Cruz as Trump's base is with him. Do you agree?
Very possibly, although I'm just going to I've given up on trying to understand what's in the minds of some of the primary voters in terms of what will sway them one direction or another. It is getting increasingly nasty in terms of the fight between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. Although there is an anti-establishment, you know, theme with or current or conviction with those voters, and seeing them move away from those two to either Rubio, and the only other person between Rubio, Cruz, and Trump that I think has a pathway, as narrow as it is, would be Kasich.
Yep.
I don't see Cruz, you know, Cruz supporters going over to Rubio or Kasich. So, if you know, and I don't see Cruz getting out. But if one of the two did, I don't know where else where those voters would go. I think they would show up. They probably would vote for, you know, one of
them. Where will the Bush money go? The $150 million that has been spent mostly in negative ads, a large portion of it on trying to actually kill off Rubio. Where does that money go?
Because most of it, I think Rubio, I think it'll splinter, though, some to Kasich.
It won't go to Trump, I can tell
you
that.
No, I think
much.
Kasich and Rubio, and that actually might be ultimately Rubio's demise, is that if Kasich doesn't get out, and I think Kasich, you know, he does have a pathway ultimately.
I want to talk about that pathway, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Robin D. Sabatino. She's a county commissioner. She's from Marco Rubio. She's higher than a kite right now. We'll hear from her when we come back from Bradenton, Florida. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Eight years ago, there were barely more than 400,000 television homes in the entire country. By 1952, the 400,000 had grown to 18,700,000. By August 13th of 1956, there will be 36,800,000 homes in the United States equipped with television.
For more historic clips, go to museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Bradenton, Florida. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. No phone calls tonight, but if you want to email me a comment, brucedumont@museum.tv. And we are now joined on our panel by Ron DeSabatino. She is a Manatee County, Florida commissioner. Nice to have you with us. And when I said we're higher than a kite, I was not talking about your personal thought. I was talking about your political excitement. We talked last night, and I sort of interrupted the results when I called you, but you were very excited, obviously, with your support of Senator Marco Rubio. Why are you for Marco Rubio?
There's a lot of reasons why I'm for Marco, but number one, I just wanted to say thank you for inviting me to this panel. Good. And looking forward to the great dialogue with these wonderful speakers here today. And I met Marco back in 2009 when he was running against the then Governor Charlie Crist. Mm-hmm. And I was at a meeting in Orlando, and my husband and I were invited to his suite. And just to meet him, his wife, his children, the grandmother, and we were just taken with him at that moment. And he has a great story.
The big question that I have with Ted Cruz and with Marco Rubio and with John Kasich, within the next month, each of them has to run against Donald Trump in their home state.
Yep.
And each of them at this moment, mm-hmm. with the exception of Kasich, and Kasich is slightly behind Trump, but each of those, Trump appears to be the guy to beat in the home states of the people that are still standing. So my question to you, and as of this moment, Ted Cruz is in second place in Florida, and Rubio was third, and Bush was fourth. So what happens now? Because we all know a split between Bush and Rubio. Okay, how do you mend that fence, Robin?
Well, we all know in politics you can argue with each other on the dais or at a meeting, and then you go shake hands and you try to do what's best for the great good. So I'm hoping that since our former governor, who was a great governor in the state of Florida, now embraces his young protege and to make sure that –
Susan, how difficult is that going to be?
I would like to also add to the – and Tom will also remember this – that they served in the state house at the same time. You know, Rubio and Bush were there, and there's a lot of history. And Rubio has a lot of baggage that has yet to come out. I mean, the Floridians know about it, but I don't know if the rest of the country knows about it. And
let's discuss it because that's what this program is about.
Right. And I'd like to discuss that because a lot of that, quote, baggage that you're talking about, that goes on all the time. And people will charge things and get paid back.
You're talking about the credit cards.
The credit card thing. But, you know, no one's perfect, and you can find skeletons in everyone's closet. And that's frankly why a lot of people don't run for either local office,
sure.
or state, because they're going to drag out everything they can.
Frank, how deep is this rift? I mean, again, the national media has talked about it. You know, there was a mentor relationship. One thing about mentor relationships, they always end. Sometimes they end poorly. But in this particular case, I mean, Jeb Bush has spent over $25 million really sticking it to Marco Rubio. He wasn't trying to get rid of anybody else. He was trying to get rid of his protege. So, I mean, how do you cure that in less than 3 weeks?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was a betrayal. I mean, if I'm Jeb Bush, this isn't just, oh, hey, I'm running. Mm-hmm. You've betrayed me, buddy, and I'm not going to let go of that.
Betrayed in what way?
He ran.
Jeb was out. It was clear that Jeb was going to make this run, and Marco decided to run. He's got a right to do that, and it may well be that he was right to make that decision. But I'm just saying, if it's me, and Jeb Bush is a bigger man than I am, but I would be upset.
I think Jeb ultimately is not vindictive. I think he's angry and has every right to be angry, but I don't think he'd attempt to sabotage.
We'll see.
Yeah, but if anybody stole Jeb's thunder, it's definitely Rubio.
Absolutely.
So you're right. It's a lot to swallow. He might not come in at this point in time. It may take him a little bit longer to actually get over it.
I don't expect hugs, kisses, and high fives, but I don't think.
Well, Jeb is certainly not going to be for Trump.
What is
the relationship with Cruz? I want to come back to you, Robin. Right. But what is the relationship with Cruz? Because I don't see Bush and Cruz going after each other in any real visceral way during the campaign thus far. Is there an opportunity to, in fact, during the speech last night, obviously Cruz threw nice bouquets to Jeb, as did Marco Rubio. The only one that didn't say a word was Donald Trump. Which I thought was a lack of class.
I don't think Bush will ever endorse Cruz. I just don't. I think in the end, he probably will support Rubio, but he'll be incredibly reluctant.
He might support Kasich first.
And Kasich, actually, that's a good point, because
well, they
Kasich
were governors together.
Yeah. Correct.
Robin, we're spending a lot of time on this because so much is going to depend on literally what happens in the state of Florida. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're talking with people that know all about it right now. You know where all the bodies are buried. So.
Yeah, I do.
share, please.
Ohio and Florida are the two states that you know one needs to win an election, and he's divided between Florida and Ohio. I just think that at the end of the day, Bush will rise to the occasion because it is his home state, and I think he will at the end of the day support our homegrown Marco. And let's face it, he's a young family. I don't think there's a time that he's spoken that you don't always have a smile on your face looking at him delivering his message. And it's just the message that's out there. And it's I was just doing some statistics because
there
I love
certainly
doing
isn't
that.
A time when he does not have a smile on his face.
Right.
I mean, I think that's one of his endearing things.
Exactly.
I mean, Trump is always scowling. Rubio was always smiling.
And Jeff is kind of, I'm not just going to say, kind of awkward.
He was.
I was doing some statistics for Florida, and the votes, the population under 18 is 20%, and over 65 is 19. So you have, you have like the older establishment, and then you have a lot of younger people that Rubio will appeal to.
Let me just say one thing on Rubio's challenge. I think it's the Bush. How does he get along with Jeb, and what happens there? Mm-hmm. This is a very big state. It's a very populous state, and it's a large geographic state. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Marco Rubio is well known in South Florida.
Yep.
You know, but that doesn't always translate well, you know, to other parts of the state.
Right.
So he's going to have to, and you know, when he ran for Senate, it was a very weak race. He was running against a, you know, Charlie Crist, who turned into an independent, a weak Democrat. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he really hasn't had the ultimate test in Florida. Now, he might rise to the occasion, but it's a tough state.
Geographically, is there prejudice? I mean, we're in central, western Florida. I mean, we're not in the panhandle. We're a long way from the panhandle. But geographically, is there a prejudice against people from South Miami?
Maybe not a prejudice.
Is there an East Coast, West Coast split?
It's a different world.
It's
a different state, and you could carve the state up into about five
pieces. Amalgam of five.
Does he spend much time here? Has Rubio spent much time here?
Not since.
No, I mean, he's been here a couple of times. I don't think he stands out for not, but not a whole lot. One of the things, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the north part of Florida, it's the south.
Yeah.
The southeast is the northeast.
Right.
The southwest where we are, that's really the Midwest.
Midwest. Yeah. A lot of Chicago.
I-4 corridor is like Exurbia, Suburbia, America, an amalgam of everything. And they say Key West is like little San Francisco.
Yeah, we're a transplant state. So the allegiance, what you would automatically think would be to Florida, really isn't. It's from where they're from. And they just happen to vote down here because of the homestead exemptions or whatever else.
So it's an interesting combination.
So you can't predict Florida, which is why we're always a swing state.
But the way you just described the state, Frank, sounds like this state is perfect for Donald Trump.
It may vary. You know, it may vary. I'm waiting again. The ceilings that I attributed to Donald Trump, he's kind of blown through them. So he is the odds-on favorite at the moment. I don't know where his ceiling is. He's running in the 30 to 40%, but one of the surprises over the last couple of weeks from New Hampshire down to South Carolina is he's, as you mentioned, he's beating some of the home crowd on their own turf, and he's appealing to a number of different evangelicals mocked up in New Hampshire. Yeah. And so that diversity, I think there's a better than 50% chance that
by the way,
he holds on. You know?
We should mention that Joe Gruters, who is the vice chairman of the Florida Party, probably the highest, you know, official in the state. He is supporting Donald Trump. He is the state chairman.
Campaign. Mm-hmm.
He's running the campaign. He was supposed to be here tonight, and we got a call late today that he's not going to be here because the campaign hasn't approved it. Now, Robin, you were going to be here anyway. But again, it's kind of surprising that the state chairman of Florida is not here to. Well, and as you say, he's a very articulate, boisterous guy and would be a real pro-Trump supporter. But he's not here tonight.
Right.
That's more time for you, Robin.
Well, and when it's more time for me. When I heard that he was supporting Trump, personally, I still thought it was a conflict of interest, him representing the entire state and the political state of the Republicans. So, and I spoke with the Manatee County chair, and she also thought that, you know, it was a conflict because the chairs and the party have to stay neutral during a primary. You can't endorse or support one over the other. Personally, you can have your personal favorites, but, you know, the party chair can't endorse and back one candidate versus another.
But looking ahead again to the 15th of March, Florida is Trump's to lose at the moment. Would you say that?
I would say, yeah, yes, I would. You know, in many places, the opposition are looking for Trump's comments on Medicare and Social Security. Mm-hmm. Those are the holy grails. So, yeah,
and the Hispanic vote as well.
Yeah, and that's a good point.
And the Hispanic vote in Florida isn't exclusively Cuban. It's very large Cuban. I understand you're getting a large influx of Puerto Ricans that are coming to the state that may make it more of a competitive state in November against the Democratic nominee, which we'll talk about when we continue. From coast to coast and border to border, I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight live from Bradenton, Florida.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Bruce Dumont back in Bradenton, Florida. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. And we here, thanks to the folks at the Bradenton Anna Maria Island Longboat Key Convention and Visitors Bureau. And again, Elliot Falcione, we really thank him very much. Falcione, sorry about that. And again, they've been supporters of this program for a long, long time. It's great to be here in Bradenton, Florida. It's always great to be in Florida when it's real cold in Chicago, where we normally do the show. So come on down. Talking about, obviously, what happened in South Carolina yesterday and how it affects what happens in Florida on March 15th. But keep in mind, March 15th, beware of the Ides of March, because it's Florida, it's Illinois, it's Missouri, it's Ohio, and North Carolina. Big states. So, again, we're in Florida. We're talking about the impact of it because, obviously, Marco Rubio is one of the three that is left standing based on the results last evening out of South Carolina. And the exit polls had some interesting things to say. Trump voters, overwhelmingly, they liked Trump because he tells it like it is. That was his big strength. Cruz voters did very well because they liked his principles strongly. They believed in what he had to say. Rubio voters, 47% of the people that voted for Rubio voted for him because he could win. And I'm wondering, as the campaign moves forward and dealing with the reality of winning, it seems to me that the Trump people can feel good because that guy is saying exactly what I want to say. And the Cruz people can feel really strong. Boy, he really believes like I believe. In other words, it may be better and maybe more to control the party than to win an election. And then you've got Rubio, who is the practical guy, and his people seem to be saying, you know what, I've looked at this group. This is the guy, and he's got some polls on his side to suggest this is the guy that could probably do better against Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. Robin?
You read my mind exactly, because during the break I had written down all the polls show that Rubio beats Hillary or any other candidate that they would put up against him. So I think that's huge.
Kasich also beats Hillary.
Okay. I just think in a general election case, it can't pull it off. But, you know, exactly what you said, 47% believe that he can win. And so at what point do the other candidates say, I'm gonna win the primary and I'm going to go up against the Democrat, but they really don't have a long shot of winning. So,
Robin, when you watched, I assume you watched the debate from New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. When Rubio melted under the attack of Chris Christie,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What, as a politician yourself, what was going through your mind when you saw your guy fade?
I was like, oh my God, just don't talk. Don't ask the question.
That's not a good
sign.
We
say that too.
Where's the water bottle when you need it?
Yeah. Hit the brakes, because I learned from a lot of people. I mean, this is my first time in office. I ran in 2010. And when I first met Marco, and I learned early on, if you have your 3 minutes, you don't need to take them, and you can hit the brakes at any time. If you know you're repeating and you know you're explaining, then you're losing, so you need to stop. And
I got to say, though, that we've had examples in the past of Ruby cracking under pressure when the pressure is completely on him, and that's what
– Such as?
Well – Tom brought up the water bottle. I mean, something completely and easily as that then became the national laughingstock for quite some time afterwards. But even in the presidential debates, even in debates that he's done when he's run for other offices, he's still not as efficient with being the main focus. He's good right now because the focus is spread out, or it's spread on Donald, so he can stand there and smile a lot and agree with people. But
His great challenge is to look presidential. Is he looking presidential, Frank?
Most of the time.
Is his articulate? He's extremely articulate. He's extremely good looking. Are those things a liability at this point when you're 45 years old trying to prove that you're the president of the United States?
No, with some caveats. One, thing that he has to deal with, and it's come up, is that a lot of the allure in terms of his articulate the appearance of intelligence and the youth remind people of Obama, which if you're running on the right, you know, the idea that this is sort of some of the liabilities of somebody being young and not experienced and tested, are we going to make the same mistake? So he's got to ward off that.
I'm old enough to say that to me, he reminds me of John Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
The comparison is more John Kennedy, just because of the age, the ease, the telegenics. I mean, all of the things that he had. I mean, people have they're using the reference to Obama, which is not meant. It's meant to be a pejorative. But Tom, how do you see sort of the, you know, whether Rubio is looking? I mean, just physically looking presidential.
I think he is. You know. We could argue over what that means now.
Right.
But I think going back to Robin's point about the electability question, I think at the end of the day, one major question is, do Republican primary voters care about winning the election, mm-hmm. or are they just out to make a point mm-hmm. that we are fed up with mm-hmm. America and we are fed up with politics in general? And in South Carolina, I think the exit polls were showing that more than half of the people said they were angry with the party establishment mm-hmm. and sure. Republican mm-hmm. representation. So I think that is going to be a big part
of itself. Talking about the Trump movement.
Yes.
Because here's the comparison I would make. If we're going to look at the Trump movement, I look at the Goldwater movement. The Goldwater movement was about controlling the party. Well, they didn't really care if they won the election.
Right.
They wanted to control the party. Mm-hmm. Same thing with McGovern in 72. You could argue that's the same thought that Bernie Sanders has, controlling the party. Maybe. So I'm wondering whether in this fervor, which may not be based on extensive political acumen, and I don't mean to insult the Trump voters because they're out there and they're dedicated, and it's, you know, 35-40% of the vote, and you can't turn your back on them. But politically, they may not be as sophisticated as someone else's voters, as frankly as Rubio's voters.
Yeah, I don't think they understand
because you've got to win it. You got to win
the.
In other words, if you want to control the Supreme Court, folks, the first thing you've got to do is you have to elect a president
right.
of your party.
Yeah,
and if they don't get that, if they just want to feel good about it, well, then they're not going to feel very good if Hillary Clinton is the president of the United States.
And I don't think that the Trump supporters acknowledge that there's that potential trade-off there. I think they buy into it. They're angry, and I think they think that they can win. Looking at demographics, it's hard for me as a political scientist to understand how you're going to win the electoral college, the electoral college in the United States, with a very growing and important salient Hispanic population, mm-hmm. and overall the biggest segment of America, it's women. And so I think come election day in a general election, how you're going to win an electoral college unless you really own significant margins in terms of the Hispanic voters and women, and the rhetoric that's coming out of the Trump campaign, which has worked very well in the primaries, how that can possibly translate into an electoral college win. I don't understand it, but there's a lot that I don't understand that surprises me.
Well, that's why, Robin, I want to get back to you. That's why I think we're focusing a lot of time on what Marco Rubio is able to do in this state where we're doing this program from. Because if he's making the case that I am the most electable guy, he must, in my view, he must win the Florida primary, not finish second. Mm-hmm. He's got to win it. And at the moment, he's a long way behind.
Well, and that's good. And also, getting back to the statistics, the Hispanics are 24, almost 25% of the voters here in Florida. So mm-hmm. that goes to his advantage.
How many of those are Cuban?
It's not broken down Hispanic.
Okay. Hispanic voters are not monolithic.
And
I mean,
Latino.
A lot of Mexicans don't like Cubans. A lot of Cubans
sure,
don't
and,
like
and a lot of the
Puerto
Hispanics,
Ricans, and that's part of the
– A lot of the Hispanics are actually more Democrat than they are
right.
Republican. So and, you can't just –
And they may be jealous of the Cubans because Cubans have a lot of political power in this state.
Bruce, more than important, I think, than the optics of finishing second, I think one of the things we just point out in terms of the Republican primary process is that on March 15th – it converts from you have to allocate delegates proportionally to states have options of winner take all, including Florida, which has chosen to do a winner take all primary. So regardless of how things are turning out, the delegate count's going to be pretty tight. Even if Trump's running pretty well and winning a lot of states, the delegate's going to be pretty tight, the delegate count, until March 15th. At that point, you convert to some states winner take all. So if there's suddenly another candidate surging ahead, mm-hmm. even if they've been finishing second or third, can easily win the nomination. Mm-hmm. But if Trump wins in Florida, it's 99 delegates. If he holds on at that point and you're not seeing somebody surpass him, running a close second or third ain't going to matter much anymore
and also,
after March 15th.
And also, before Rubio is put up on the block to see if he can win, Ted Cruz has got to beat Donald Trump in Texas.
Absolutely.
On March 1st.
Absolutely.
And John Kasich, if he's putting all of his eggs basically in Ohio, and on October or March 15th.
If Rubio doesn't win Florida, there, if Cruz doesn't win Texas, if Kasich doesn't win Ohio,
it's over.
Yeah.
It's over. One last question to you, Robin, because you're going to be with us for a little bit longer, but I want to ask this question because this has been floated and I need a quick answer. Some have suggested that Marco Rubio should ask John Kasich right now to be his running mate. Is that a good idea?
I don't think anything. No, that's not a good idea at this point.
Does anybody think that's a good idea right now, in a strategic way? Is that a good idea?
No. He'll be rebuffed, so it's not a good idea.
Yeah, it would look bad.
It would look too much like a deal?
No, it's what Frank said, is that Kasich won't accept it, and then mm-hmm. it'll make Rubio look bad and anxious, too anxious. I mean, I think if he does that, it's going to look like he thinks he's got the vote locked in, and right. that's going to turn a lot of voters off.
There's other great candidates for VP that would draw the female vote or the
– There'll be a whole – that'll be another whole 3 weeks of the campaign. We'll talk about that. Robin DiSabatino, thank you very much for being with us. You are a Marco Rubio supporter in this state. You are also a Manatee County, Florida commissioner where we're doing this program from this evening. We thank you very much. We'll be back to continue our discussion.
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown is a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
8 years ago, there were barely more than 400,000 television homes in the entire country. By 1952, the 400,000 had grown to 18,700,000. By August 13th of 1956, there will be 36,800,000 homes in the United States equipped with television.
For more historic clips, go to museum.tv. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago and back in Bradenton, Florida. I've got a creature of habit there. Nice to have you with us from coast to coast and border to border. We are definitely in Bradenton, Florida tonight. The other thing, a story that obviously was happening yesterday, was what was happening in Nevada. We're going to talk more about that in the second hour. But again, I want to have you in on Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders. Where do you come down on where that race is going on, Susan?
You know, I think it's kind of different. If we compare the race now with the Democrats as we did like in 2008, their polling shows that their Democrats consider themselves by 70% more liberal than they did in 2008. I think that's why it's a little unpredictable between Bernie and Hillary, where she is more of the traditional candidate and he's not. I think the changing electorate amongst the Democrats are going to make a really significant impact.
Frank, what do you think?
I think it's hard to undersell how big how important Hillary's win was for her in Nevada. I mean, the hand-wringing was starting to hit, you know, peak levels within the Clinton campaign. It's only a few points, but I think a lot of people started to – Bernie Sanders might win, or it would be like close. He wins by 5 points. All of the stories out today are Hillary stops the momentum. I think it's important for her chances. She's probably going to be very solid in South Carolina, and then we'll win many of the March 1 SECs, and then we'll see where it is. I think so. That was very important for her, and I think her chances are still well above 50% that she'll hold on. But you can't just discount the Sanders campaign and what they've been able to accomplish. Mm-hmm. I think they're raising enough money that they're going to be in it for a long haul. I don't think this thing is going to end quickly.
Tom, do you get a sense that the spirit of the college age students, the males, that's happening in Florida, that's happening in other states?
Well, anytime you talk about the younger vote in Florida, you have to balance it with this incredibly weighted older vote.
Right. Yeah.
So let's put that in perspective.
Yeah.
Now, that said.
But college students in Florida are still college students.
That's right. Yeah. So, but I'm just not sure. I think Frank would know better than I. But I don't see that as being something that would just sway a state like Florida. I mean, Hillary's people are already on the ground. You know, they've been calling us at the Herald Tribune. You know, are you going to endorse? Are you going to do this? You know, and checking in. So, I mean, she's going to run very strong.
The demographics of the state of Florida bode well for Hillary Clinton's chances here. The younger vote, though, it's just it's hard to find Hillary Clinton supporters down at that younger demographic, and I can understand why in terms of the vision and the message of Bernie Sanders' campaign. Compared to measured incremental vision for Clinton, the younger voters were really.
I think if you compare the other elections with the younger voters, though, Ron Paul had an incredible amount of younger voters. Ralph Nader, if you remember in the 2000 elections, and that was big with the younger voters.
Obama.
Barack Obama, I think he's actually the only one that they had a significant impact on making
but
it
this year.
Way.
I mentioned this last week. No matter when you are a young person, it's important to be cool and go along with the crowd. And there are people that are for Bernie Sanders that politically really are astute and they know why they're for passion.
Mm-hmm.
But part of it, I think, also is just the appeal. He's cool. He's in. He's hot.
Well,
Hillary's not to that generation.
Younger voters are feeling the burn. I mean, those T-shirts I'm feeling. That's
we have an audience question, and we're going to – ma'am, if you will just stand up and ask your question, we will get your thoughts. Go ahead.
This relates to the last segment.
Yes.
You asked a question, what happened to Jeb Bush's money?
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody answered that. I mean, if they did, I missed it. So I'd like to hear, because I feel some of the shows that I've listened to on television, they don't always answer the questions.
Good. And, well, we are going to get that question. Where did the money go other than there are literally hundreds of people that own radio and television stations around the early states that love Jeb Bush, but where else did
the
it go?
The campaign itself burned through everything. There were a lot of the money that campaign. Was reported was the super PAC money. There's still some leftover money there. One of the things that I think a lot of the public doesn't appreciate is that there are different rules with respect to especially television advertising in terms of what they can charge a campaign versus a super PAC. So super PAC spending money traditionally in terms of TV advertisements, man, you can burn that really, really quickly. Most of the Jeb Bush money has been burned through. There's some left over in the super PAC that'll go to other places, but the campaign money, gone. They burned through.
Someone was suggesting yesterday that because of what happened to Jeb Bush with all the money, because he raised more money than anybody else, that Donald Trump being self-funded and Bernie Sanders getting donations an average of $27 – that the people are already rebelling against Citizens United. You agree with that, Tom, to some extent?
Yes. But it doesn't matter. Right. I mean, that's my most pessimistic thing I'm going to say today, is Citizens United, whatever people think about it, doesn't matter.
I think it matters in a variety of different ways. I think the people are rebelling about I don't know how far this goes, but I think that's one of the good things. As crazy as this election season is, the lack of impact of the super PACs, I think that part of it's a good thing.
Although, you know what, though? One of the interesting trends, and we won't get too local here, but we're starting to see the PACs, the quiet political action, the mm-hmm. political committees, they're starting to have significant influence locally.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, that's a big, this is a longer conversation, but I think that Citizens United and a lot of PAC activity matter further down the ticket than they do at the very
top. But with every personal donation, it counts as a vote. And you don't get that when you get these major donations with PACs. And I think that is something that you cannot disregard.
Control of the United States Senate is going to be very important, especially as it relates to the Supreme Court. So my question to you, there is now an open seat. Marco Rubio is not seeking reelection. Give us a quick analysis of where the race to replace Marco Rubio is. Tom?
Nobody knows the candidates.
Yeah, that's true.
By and large,
they don't have name recognition.
I, in 35 years of covering politics that I've ever experienced, you could go to the street. I couldn't even tell you who they are right now, off the top of my head, probably.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of them.
And
maybe
Roof
one to come.
Is,
yeah.
One.
But it's amazing. This is an incredibly light field in terms of, experience. Not that that matters, I don't know.
And it costs a lot.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton Los Angeles Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. It was Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv.
8 years ago, there were barely more than 400,000 television homes in the entire country. By 1952, the 400,000 had grown to 18,700,000. By August 13th of 1956, there will be 36,800,000 homes in the United States equipped with television.
For more historic clips, go to museum.tv. Bruce Dumont back in Bradenton, Florida. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. We have no phone calls tonight. But again, if you want to send me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. If you want to send me a tweet, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web at beyondthebeltway.com. And we welcome three new guests in this segment. But first of all, we want to talk about what happened in Nevada last night. I think you all know, but the Nevada caucus was yesterday, and Hillary Clinton ended up with 53% of the caucus voters, 52.7% to be exact. Bernie Sanders, 47.2. There's about a 500, 600 vote difference there, so not a huge difference. But again, it's bragging rights for Hillary Clinton to get back on track and to win something. And, we've got a new panel of guests, and we want to get their reaction. Sherrod Halliburton joins us. He's a political activist. Sherrod, what is your what's your take about what happened in Nevada yesterday and what it means for the Democratic Party race for the presidency?
Well, I definitely think it was a win that Hillary needed to have. I think she's better positioned as she moves to the SEC primaries, you know, given the makeup of those demographics. But if she had suffered a loss, I think that would have been potentially damaging in regards to not viewing her as a strong candidate that they did before. So she definitely needed a win.
Political commentator Judy Sedgman joined us. Judy, what's your reaction of what happened out of Nevada yesterday?
Well, it was tight. I'm disappointed in the turnout. They said it was much smaller than it was in the past. Nonetheless, I think Hillary really comported herself extremely well. It gave her the opportunity to give, I think, the best speech she's given since she started her campaign. It was a complete turnaround in my mind. She had the chance as a winner. She was modest enough not to call it huge. And she spoke, I think, eloquently about everybody and about her vision for the very first time in the campaign.
Eric Hodges joins us. He is with the University of South Florida here in Sarasota. And a question to you is,
okay,
what was your reaction and to what extent were you surprised that Bernie Sanders, in a short amount of time, was able to win the Hispanic vote?
That's really surprising. And I've heard that he won by people rejecting by 8%, actually had won the Hispanic vote. But I've also heard some people claim that there's no way that Hillary would have won Clark County by that margin if he had actually won the 8% with the Hispanic vote. Mm-hmm. But I do think that that's really important, you know, and oftentimes you hear people trying to sort of, you know, say Hillary really has a stranglehold on the minority vote. But as you were talking about sort of in the first hour, you know, there's a lot of different views and a lot of opinions within that minority vote. So I think that
she won 71% of the African-American vote. And that obviously that is where her focus is as she heads to the SEC primary and Super Tuesday. Sherrod, you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. It's really interesting because Bernie Sanders' message, if you listen to it, one would think it might resonate with the African-American community, some of the things he's speaking to. But there's history with the Clinton family. It's not just Hillary. There's Bill. And so there is a lot of support in the African-American community for Hillary, and it really dates back. Younger African-Americans are not as tied to the Clintons. So you may see a break with the younger African-Americans. Question is, will they come out and vote?
Yeah, for the older African-Americans, you said that there's a history with the Clintons.
Yes.
The history goes back to basically 2008 when Hillary and Barack Obama were locked in a battle. And when the campaign specifically went to South Carolina, there were charges of racism that were being thrown at Bill Clinton, that he was playing the race card there by talking about Jesse Jackson. So there's sort of a – if you look at the short-term history in South Carolina with the Clintons, it isn't all good.
I would say short term, absolutely. But I do think that there's still that strong relationship. Hillary was running against Barack Obama, the right. first African-American president. So that was kind of a tense situation. But I do think moving beyond that and looking at Hillary and looking at the other candidate, I think that Hillary's going to be able to maintain a strong component of black votes.
Judy. Go ahead.
You I want would to say just something. To add to that, I think it's generational more than it is demographic. In other words, I think the demographic split is really younger people are just motivated by Bernie. And, you know, the older demographics are saying, well, you know, but Hillary is tried and true and tested and she says she can do it and we've seen her do things. So I do think that it's even among Latinos and African Americans, there's going to be a generational split.
I think you're right on the money with that. And if you look at, you know, the votes that came in for Sanders yesterday, I think he carried the day pretty much in everybody under 40. But you got the group 65 and above.
Yeah.
Clinton had such an amazing advantage there. So in some ways, it seems like to me the Democratic primary, it's almost like a clash of generations.
Yeah.
in some ways,
mm-hmm.
Which
the
is interesting.
Is. The message is, very much
is that I mean, really, since we're talking about the Democrats now, is this really a ticking time bomb for the Democratic Party that they may have a front runner who is maybe a clear front runner, but the enthusiasm level is way down. And if she is engaged in a general election against a Donald Trump, who apparently is like a prairie fire at the moment. But again, we haven't seen him in a one-on-one. But the energy level just between those two candidates is sort of night and day, isn't it, Eric?
No, I think it is. But I think in a way, too, that Hillary could be seen, Secretary Clinton could be seen to have extreme poise as well. I don't think it's low energy in the same way that you would say that maybe Jeb Bush, as he was accused by Trump, had low energy.
Yeah,
I think it's a type of quiet confidence that she has.
And it's interesting that she and Donald are at the same age.
Yeah.
So, you know, people forget that he's as old as he is. It never comes up.
And these people, they always look good. I mean, I'm a little bit older, but I'm figuring how do they keep that, especially Bernie Sanders is like, although Donald Trump said the other night in an interview that that he only needs 3 or 4 hours of sleep, and that's pretty much the way he's been all of his life, kind of an mm-hmm. interesting thing. By the way, this is an observation that I wanted to make is that, you know, I don't think anyone can really say that in this campaign they don't know where candidates stand. Mm-hmm. There have been so many debates, so many forums. People that still say that, really, I don't know where they've been. They're not listening. They're flipping the channels too much during the debate and forums. But CNN did something earlier this week. They did back-to-back town halls with the Republican candidates. They also had done one with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And I think as both political parties look to the next campaign cycle, I think they should front-load all of the national appearances in the town halls first. Let the candidates explain who they are. Let's find the soft side to them. Let's find the fun side. What do they do? Let's understand them as human beings. Let's find out where they have an opportunity to really lay out their plans for the country. And then go to the debates where they knock the hell out of each other. Because right now it's backward. I mean, the first time that a lot of people see these candidates, they've got 15 seconds to explain a very complex issue, right. And then they're doing battle with someone that wants the same job. So my advice to the media is next time, do all the town forums first, the town hall meetings first. And again, I thought that CNN and Anderson Cooper did a great job in at least introducing the Republicans this past week. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Bradenton, Florida tonight.
Eight years ago, there were barely more than 400,000 television homes in the entire country. By 1952, the 400,000 had grown to 18,700,000. By August 13th of 1956, there will be 36,800,000 homes in the United States equipped with television.
For more historic clips, go to museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont, thank you very much for joining us tonight live from Bradenton, Florida. And I want to talk a little bit about, as we look towards the general election. Judy, I want to start with you. What's the key? I mean, Florida is always a swing state.
Yeah.
First of all, do you agree that given the influx of a lot of Puerto Ricans from Puerto Rico to Florida, is this going to be less of a swing state? Is this going to, within the next couple of presidential cycles, be more of a reliable Democratic state in your view?
You know, that's a really tough call because, first of all, I don't think that I think it's not clear that any Latin American demographic vote says a block. I mean, there's so many different opinions and so many different people. And I also think that in Florida, because the state is so different, I mean, the Panhandle and Miami are like you might as well be talking about the East of, you know, the Middle East and the and Russia and far west. Yeah. You know, it's crazy. So it really, to some extent, depends where they are they come here and how they're influenced by local politics. So I do think that Florida's position as a swing state is also very much influenced by influx of retirees, and you have these sort of waves coming from different parts of the country.
I think it also depends, too, on the direction the Republican Party goes.
Absolutely.
You know, if the Republican Party does nominate Marco Rubio, then, yeah, I mean, it may actually go the other direction. But, you know, if Trump ends up winning the nomination, then – yeah, what Bruce's comment.
I don't see Marco Rubio as having a really strong hold on the Latino vote, though, because he is basically – he wants to put an end to the DREAM Act, you know, just cut it off on day one, he said. He's anti-immigration. He's anti – wants to, you know, build a wall just like Donald Trump. He's been pulled so far to the right of where he used to be that – I'm not positive that his name alone is going to carry him with that demographic.
And it would be interesting to see if he does get the nomination, if he goes back to the center, you know, versus to the far right where he's been forced in the primary. So,
well, I think it's also – I think as I said in the first hour of the broadcast is that, you know, it is – it's faulty analysis to think that, you know, the Hispanic vote is monolithic because there is a lot of cultural differences.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, frankly, you know – a lot of Puerto Ricans don't like the Cubans, and the Cubans don't like the Puerto Ricans, and you know, a lot of people don't like the Mexicans. Then you got the Colombians. I mean, it's not an easy fix because your name ends. I think, as a political commodity, I don't think it's Rubio's Cuban American and lineage or heritage that makes him powerful. I think it's his age. I think it's his demographic. Mm-hmm. I think it's his ability to be articulate. And a concern that I would have is that I don't see him having – I mean, clearly the guy with the biggest blue-collar appeal is Trump.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think Casey coming from Ohio, he won by 30 points. Yeah. He has blue-collar appeal.
Mm-hmm.
I think Cruz has blue-collar appeal. Culturally speaking, I don't think Marco Rubio has blue-collar appeal. I think he has suburban soccer mom appeal.
Yeah.
Which also is a way, if you're going to win a Republican primary election, you got to do well with the soccer moms. So I see him doing better with them than necessarily with he doesn't seem to be a guy that you're going to go out and have a beer.
But you know the debate in which he was attacked and he came off as very scripted, I think, questions.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that those questions have gone away. I mean, you saw this young man. He was very impressive, has a wonderful life story. It's the American dream. And you can get caught up in that. But when it appeared as if it was just a script, I have to say, watching it, it was difficult to watch.
Oh.
I that now there's questions about, is he indeed ready for the big jump? And I don't know that that question has gone away. I think that's going to be a big challenge for him in moving forward.
Yeah. How does he get ready? Because the logical place where he might be able to get ready is, as everyone does, go back to the last Republican president or go back to the last Democratic president. He's got to go back to George W. Bush's sort of foreign policy team, which, again, you don't know whether they're going to be willing to step up and help Marco Rubio.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and so your question is, how does he actually get over sort of
How does he answer the question? I mean, he's always, at least for this cycle, he's going to look like the youngest guy. I mean, you know, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz are the same age.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Cruz comes across like he's 10 years older.
Yes.
Well, but I guess one answer to that would be the fact that the Republican establishment largely seems to be coalescing behind Rubio. And I'm sure that he would have a lot of support among more senior senators and the more experienced Washington players who could, you know, hopefully come in and help him fill some of those gaps.
The question that I have, though, about Rubio is he's well prepared, but I don't know that he can think on his feet. And I don't know if he has the command of information or whether he's just memorized an awful lot of talking points. It's just not clear yet. And it's going to be very interesting. I'd love to see him debate.
I think you're Trump. Well, I think that's what some of the Democrats are saying is the person that they fear the most is Rubio. And I think the reason they fear him is the generational gap.
Yes.
I mean, the huge generational gap of an older woman and a young, you know, articulate.
He's an affable
man.
Guy too. I mean,
always with a smile. I mean, he always ends whatever he ends it with that big grin of his, and it's engaging. Whereas, you know, Trump he's a scowl at the top and a scowl at the bottom, but you know, he's leading the pack at the moment, Sherrod.
But it's really interesting. You know, the Democrats are saying, hey, bring on Trump. I think they are not counting the fact that there are Democrats that are attracted to Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just Trump maxes out at 35-40% on the Republican side. I know a lot of Democrats who find appeal in Trump's message. I think that message of winning for some people, as simplistic as it is, I mean, I'm waiting for a real message. But I think that message of winning is appealing to people who feel like they are not winning in their own life.
Let me ask the question that I asked the last panel. A quick yes or no. Can Donald Trump be elected president of the United States, Sherrod?
I think he could.
I think
Judy.
He could.
Eric.
I don't know.
No, you got to. You can get away with that in the classroom. Right now, you got to say, "What does your gut tell you?"
My gut tells me no.
No, okay,
yeah.
You can insult.
And by the way, in the last hour, we had basically the same split.
I can defend my answer too.
Yeah. Okay,
right. Okay,
because it seems like every demographic can grow. Anything is possible.
But you also have to remember all those years that he actually was more of a Democrat than a Republican. And I think there were a lot of Democrats that are sitting around saying, you know, he's not really a Republican.
When he comes out and says whether he really was against the Iraq war, he certainly has said it in this campaign. But when he came out and attacked George Bush and the weapons of mass destruction, and then he lied. I mean, That's a Democrat talking point. And some
is.
Of the things that he's saying recently, even about, Obama, he's picking up other things and he's
Planned
today. He's not letting Planned Parenthood. I mean, when he said that a week ago Saturday, I almost fell off my chair. I can't believe. I mean, I think he's right. Planned Parenthood does do some good things.
But you're not supposed to say that if you're Republican.
He's saying all kinds of things that he shouldn't be saying.
And he may have been lulled into a false sense of security, because I believe that the people who are supporting Trump now have already made up their minds regardless of what he says. But I do think that there's a ceiling there. So, you know, this him making comments about George W. Bush and not protecting us during 9/11 and his comments about the Pope, I don't think his numbers have necessarily risen since then, but they haven't fallen either, because those people have already made up their minds that that's the direction they want to go. And I think that may be a ceiling for him as well in the general election.
Trot, I want to go back to what you said, though. He has potential. I'm asking you. he has potentially black appeal.
Oh, yeah.
There is appeal. Not for me particularly.
The other night in this Q&A with Anderson Cooper, he goes into this long thing about Michael Jackson, that he knew Michael Jackson. I mean, it was I'm thinking of the people that are moved to vote for people that they're not the most politically astute.
Yeah.
They're low information voters. That's the new name for people that don't read a lot. Low information voters. But he has this celebrity culture. I mean, he knew Michael Jackson. I mean, there's a lot of people that would be interested in his thought just because he was a celebrity. And he's been a celebrity for 40 years in this country.
It's really interesting that you say that. Last time I was at home, my brother and sister-in-law, well-educated, my brother-in-law is a truck driver. He loved Trump, and he was talking about Trump. My sister-in-law asked the question, do you know his platform? How is his platform going to affect your life? He couldn't answer the question, but it didn't stop him from loving Trump. Right. So to your point, he was on the low information side. She was very well informed. She felt his positions would not help this young man, but he was just so excited about the celebrity of it all. I think there's that celebrity appeal. I think there's that winning.
Yeah.
But that's responding to
it. Is it feasible to believe that he could get any sort of advantage over Secretary Clinton in a general election with the African-American vote?
I think that there is a small segment. I mean, I think he could probably have more appeal than the average Republican candidate.
Would you think more than Senator Sanders? Do you think that Donald Trump could have more appeal to African Americans than Senator
Sanders? Donald Trump is a shapeshifter. He can do it. You know, he finds a way to make himself whatever he needs to be in the moment, which is fascinating. I mean, it's a little unsettling, frankly, to me. I just like, yeah. Oh my gosh, but he's able to make himself appear to be on your side.
Shrewd politician.
No, he's
crazy like a fox.
Chameleon, yeah, crazy like a fox. That's well put. When we come back, we have lots more to talk about. Another half hour to go. Wherever you're listening, from coast to coast and border to border, tonight we are doing it from Manatee County in Florida. That is the Bradenton area. We're just a stone's throw from Sarasota down the road. You may be familiar with that as well. So if you're looking for a place to come for vacation, Bradenton, Florida. Back shortly from Bradenton. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Bruce Dumont back in Bradenton, Florida, and our guests in this segment of the program are Eric Hodges. He is University of South Florida at Sarasota. Judy Hedgman joins us. She is a political commentator, and Sherrod Halliburton. He is a political activist, and they are with us. And I want to get your reaction to what happened in South Carolina yesterday. And we have spoken earlier in the broadcast about whether or not Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio can kiss and make up and come back together in less than 3 weeks and present some believable endorsement or encouragement to help Marco Rubio in the March 15th primary. Is that a doable thing in your view, Eric?
I think it is. I thought Governor Bush showed a lot of grace in his speech last mm-hmm. night to suspend his campaign. And I think that he demonstrated that he was willing to put the party above himself. And I think if he genuinely believes that Rubio is the best chance that the Republican Party has, especially, you know, in keeping with his conservative values, then I think he would support Rubio.
But he has spent over $25 million ripping Marco Rubio apart, saying that he's not ready to be president of the United States. And some would argue that if he was really wanted to do something good for the party, he probably should have kept that $25 million and not ripped up someone from his own state.
I think that's politics. I mean, I really do.
Judy, you know, is it just politics or there's a personal thing here?
Yeah.
It's more than just politics with those two, isn't it?
I think it's become more than just politics because of the mentor-mentee relationship and the fact that Jeb really thought he should wait his turn. But I also – I think that Jeb's intense dislike and the Bush family's intense dislike of Donald Trump will probably bring him around, you know, because that – and you have to look at that. It's sort of like you look at this, okay, I really am awfully mad at Marco, but, I can't.
Would it be believable if he endorsed Ted Cruz?
No.
Because I think the establishment fears Ted Cruz more.
The establishment can't stand Ted Cruz. I don't think it'd be believable.
Sherrod, do you
agree
with that?
Oh, I definitely agree with that. Interesting though, we've seen this happen before. We saw this with Hillary and Obama.
Right.
You know, we saw. You guys remember the television commercial about the 3 o'clock phone call?
Uh-huh. Right.
Uh-huh. You know, who would you want to answer the phone? And I think they made up quite well. And in fact, Hillary was in his cabinet. So I think this is par for the course. Our former governor appears to be a team player. I'm quite sure personally there's some hard feelings, but I think he has a higher commitment to the party. Now, the question is believable. I think very clearly they're going to come together and kiss and make up. Question is it going to be believable?
And
well,
the other reality is,
right now is that Bush was running fourth in Florida in
5%.
The primaries.
Yeah.
And Rubio was running third, and
right.
Cruz was running
right.
second, and right. Trump had a double-digit lead. So is it really going to make any difference what Bush and Rubio do? Because, as I said in the first segment, Rubio's got to win Florida, I think, right. just like Ted Cruz has got to win Texas and John Kasich's got to win Ohio.
Yeah, it's going to play.
How do you say you're electable?
It's going to play into Rubio's narrative, though, because Rubio is saying, "I'm the person that can unite the Republican Party."
The establishment.
So if he can't unite the Republican Party in Florida, he's really up against it.
Well, I think a lot of that's going to play out in the SEC primaries as well on Super Tuesday. You know, I think if he demonstrates that he can actually win some of those states and make a very strong showing, then I think he stands a really good chance in Florida.
But
if
he runs third in Florida? He could run third in Florida.
That's going to be a problem.
He's done.
Because
it's over.
The Republican Party has to win Florida.
Yeah. I think,
so
honestly,
that's gonna be a party.
Even at this point, I think that Rubio's really his only chance of getting the nomination at this point would be a brokered convention. I don't think that he is going to get the majority of the votes where things currently stand. So
in the last segment, I floated the idea, which has been floated before. I floated it a couple of weeks ago. And that is that Rubio should reach out to Kasich and offer in a back channel, offer him the vice presidency. Because when I saw in that very first debate, when I saw the split screen of Kasich and Rubio together, I said, you know what? That, in my view, is a winning ticket. That's certainly a very strong ticket. Judy, you agree with that? If not winning, is that the strongest Republican ticket? Is that the ticket that you would be most fearful of?
No, I think it would be a strong ticket. But it's sort of like Obama-Biden. You want your older, wiser, more experienced person who's been a governor. And in Biden's case, it's somebody who's been everywhere. But I don't think it's going to happen because I think that the fear is that Kasich is right in that category of people nobody wants to elect anymore because they represent the establishment. Rubio is trying to have it both ways. He wants to be the new generation, the young hot guy. And, you know, the establishment loves me just like everybody else.
But with a winner-take-all Ohio primary, he could end up with a big chunk of votes and head towards a brokered convention.
Well, I mean, Ohio is – there are those people who argue Ohio is as important as Florida,
right.
those two states.
And you've got Florida and Ohio and Illinois and North Carolina and Missouri all on the side. They're not even calling that Super Tuesday. That's March 15th.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So, I mean, that is
a lot
of votes.
I see it as an incredible ticket, but I don't see Kasich at this stage even being willing to consider that. For him to consider that at this point is
– yeah.
It's suggesting that he can't go any further.
He still has a path.
And I think he's hoping he still has a path. I mean, he's the only moderate. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that I would call him the establishment candidate as much because the establishment is not a moderate
candidate. Right. You know, it's still to the right.
He's also going to be able to see what is going to happen in Texas. As I said, Texas, that's on March 1st. Mm-hmm. So if Cruz does not win Texas, that's a black mark against him. If Rubio doesn't win on the 15th, that's happening at the same time. So, I mean, there could be two big thuds politically, mm-hmm. and Kasich will have rolled the dice to think that Ohio is going to be the exception. Maybe that's what gets him back, especially if he does well on March 8th in Michigan, which is also right. Kasich should do well there.
Right. No, I think that's a super important date.
Nothing's going to happen to him unless there's a brokered convention. I mean, he's never going to get enough delegates.
No.
And if there is – and he wins at a brokered convention, what happens with Trump? Does he run as an independent?
Right.
Yes.
You know, so I think it's dangerous. And
what does your gut tell you?
I think Trump is about Trump. Mm-hmm. Trump wants to be president, and he sees the Republican Party as a pathway to do it. Once it no longer is a pathway to do it, he still wants to be president. And he knows he has his voters locked up. I think very clearly he runs as an independent if he does not get the establishment nod.
I agree with that. Judy, I want to get reaction from Judy and Eric.
Well, Trump is a spoiler. If he doesn't get his way, you're not going to get your way. So I think he would run as an independent just because it's like, okay, guys, I told you couldn't win without me.
Would he have reason to do that? I mean, what we have right now is we have – the clearest, the strongest, the most loyal slice of the Republican electorate is somewhere 34-35%. Maybe it was a little – that was what it was in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. You've got a slice of the Republican electorate that that the establishment Republicans are saying, you know what, we absolutely hate you. We know we need you, but we really don't want you. Right. So if the party gangs up to basically rub this 35%, rub their face in the ground.
Right.
Why wouldn't that 35% go to support their leader if basically he can say anything he wants? And if he says, let's go, you know, we're walking out of the convention in Cleveland, they're walking out with him, I think.
I don't think Trump is an ideologue. I don't think he's wedded to any particular ideology. I think he's wedded to whatever ideology he thinks will get him elected.
Winning.
Right.
Winning.
Make
winning.
America great
winning.
Again. Right?
Yeah. We're going to win.
Forget that slogan.
We're going to win.
Better than ever before.
You've got to get tired of winning.
Trump and Charlie Sheen. It's a hard image to get out of your mind.
Here's a question. Another what if. What if Bernie Sanders won the Democratic primary and it was Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump? Eric, who wins?
I think Sanders wins. I mean, that all the polling numbers that we have now point to Sanders winning that. Obviously, a lot could transpire between now and then, but right now Sanders is ahead in that race.
Judy, what do you think?
I think that we don't know enough about Sanders to predict a win because God knows what Donald Trump will dig up about Bernie Sanders. And I think in a general election, Trump is the kind of guy that can really make that socialist label ugly. Most people just understand democratic socialist, no big deal, blah, blah, blah. But I think Trump could turn it into something. It's sort of like the bring back Sarah Palin and the whole socialist, you know, thing that she produced.
So who wins it?
In my mind, I just don't know. I think Trump could win that one.
Wait, no, that wasn't an acceptable answer for me. So.
No, that's what she did there.
I said Trump could win. You know, I think Trump could
Sherrod,
win.
Sherrod, let's see. Are you gonna agree with that?
I think Trump would win. I agree with Judy in that Trump is going to jump all over the issue of Sanders announcing he's a socialist. And I think Trump is going to hit it from a perspective that raises fear in people, you know, who don't truly understand the nuanced position of the democratic socialist.
Right.
I think that is a major problem, major label to shake in a general election.
Another exit poll result from yesterday in South Carolina. 75% of those that voted for Donald Trump believe that Muslims should be excluded from entering the United States.
Yep.
In New Hampshire, it was 65%.
Right.
What signal does that send you as a voter, Judy?
Well, you know, it's kind of horrifying to me because that there are that many people in this country that have bought into the idea that prejudice is good. That's troubling to me. So the signal it sends me is how far to the right a lot of Republicans have gone away from what has been traditionally a part of our heritage as Americans, is that we welcome people here.
I want to follow up with everyone else. Again, Sherrod, thank you. Sherrod Halliburton and Judy Sedgman and Eric Hodges, thanks very much for being with us on this segment. And again, we'll continue. I'm Bruce Dumont from Bradenton, Florida. Thanks, Bruce.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE.
8 years ago, there were barely more than 400,000 television homes in the entire country. By 1952, the 400,000 had grown to 18,700,000. By August 13th of 1956, there will be 36,800,000 homes in the United States equipped with television.
For more historic clips, go to museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Bradenton, Florida. Thank you very much for joining us. And before we run out of time at the end of the program, I really want to thank Charles Clapsaddle. He's done a terrific job at METV. We've been working on this for the last several months. And again, Elliot Felcion from the Bradenton Area Convention Bureau. And again, they've been very supportive in bringing the show down here. And again, it's great. And it's nice to be on the road. And we picked this date to do the program from Florida about 7 or 8 months ago. Yeah. And we didn't know that Florida, because of the results of what happened in South Carolina last night, was going to be as big and pivotal moment with Jeb Bush dropping out and Marco Rubio doing well, ending up in second place. So again, we looked into the crystal ball and we lucked out. We were at the right time. And again, thanks to the vision of Elliot and also getting Charles Clapsaddle in the swing of things. He's done a really terrific job, so we thank them all. I want to ask you, Eric.
Sure.
Would the founding fathers look back on the campaign of 2016 and say, you know what, this is exactly what we had in mind?
I think that it is. And I'll tell you why. Because the founding fathers didn't necessarily have a lot of faith in the people as far as selecting a candidate. Right. And that's why we have all these Byzantine procedures like the Electoral College to make sure that the best candidate is going to be chosen, perhaps even irregardless of the popular vote. So I, you know, the famous saying, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. I think it's playing out very clearly in this.
Judy, what do you think the founding fathers would think of this campaign?
Well, I, as a person who loves history and reads a lot of history, they had some pretty ugly elections themselves. Sure. And you go back in some of the early election days, it was almost as ugly and vicious and personal as it is now. So I think the founding fathers would probably say, yeah, that's probably how it is.
Right. Yeah, I think it was all about this incredible system that they created with checks and balances, and it's playing itself out. Mm-hmm. The system is working the way it was designed to work. So I think they'd be pleased with that.
Well, go ahead, Judy.
The system is also keeping us from revolution turning into a bloodbath.
Right.
You know, we have a constitution that describes a form of government that no matter how people feel, they believe in what we are as a country and as a government. And I, you know, they don't like this government, but they don't dislike the idea of our government. And I think people are playing within the boundaries that were set up by the Constitution. You know, we're not out there, you know, shooting people in the street and,
right,
you know,
right,
this is not the French Revolution.
Yeah. It's a bloodless coup.
And the historic nature of it, again, as we look, I mean, we're going to have the first woman president, perhaps.
Possibly.
We're going to have the first Jewish president. Right. Perhaps the first businessman president. That's hard to believe. The first businessman president.
Or the first
Cuban American president.
Right. Yeah.
Or the first Texan born in Canada. So, I mean, we have, there's going to be history made here.
Right.
Yeah, us, no matter how you slice it, that's right.
That's right. There will be history made.
Yeah.
When you look in the closing moments that we have, in looking at the way the campaign has unfolded, what is it that – I'm going to come back to Marco Rubio because he is the home state senator. Mm-hmm. By the way, there has never been a Floridian who's been president of the United States. Is there pride in that? I mean, obviously Rubio is running third in a primary, so maybe there's not a lot of pride about that. But would you be – I'm not asking you to endorse Marco Rubio, but I mean, is there some pride in having someone from Florida be the president of the United States? There used to be.
Well, I don't know if I would say pride as much as
power.
Very clearly Party there's allegiance. Power and there's yeah. access. So, you know, to have our senator ascend to the presidency, you would expect that there would be some access that we would have that we probably would not have under other circumstances. So I would think it would be a plus.
I think that notion of loyalty has in a lot of ways gone by the wayside. I mean, perhaps especially in Florida because of the transient nature of it. There are so many yeah. people moving into Florida, so many people moving out. So that sense of deep-seated loyalty that people felt towards their states, I would say across the board is not the same, but especially in Florida.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think we have – it's hard to say what's a Floridian. You know,
yeah.
And it's
they're
hard,
a former and, something else.
And they're always from somewhere else, or they were born here, but they're marginalized by that. So I think that this is a very interesting state. It's a fascinating place to look at politics, no matter what, even on the local level. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that that's going to play into it. I really don't.
I want to come back with you folks about the first question I asked, and that is, what did South Carolina mean to you, and do you believe that Donald Trump has it wrapped up, Eric?
I think that the only chance that any of the other candidates have is if it's a brokered convention. And it's really a question of, you know, as a lot of questions, it depends, right? It depends upon if the Republicans can get their act together and get united. And I don't see it. I don't see it happening. I mean, I don't see Cruz going in. I think at best right now what we have is a three-person race. And I don't think that's going to be enough to stop Trump.
Judy.
Yeah, what it meant to me is that the Republican Party is not the party we used to think it was. And I guess maybe Mitt Romney was probably the last presidential candidate that looked like what everybody in the country understood a Republican looks like, talks
is
like,
that
and
good?
Acts like.
Is that good or bad?
I mean, it's to me, it's interesting. I could hardly say it's good. It would be good if they were defining themselves as something a little bit more substantive. You know, I think it's fine for parties to shift and change, but right now it's like they're turning into this party of hate and fear.
But then also, you know, Rubio last night in his victory speech called himself a child of Reagan. You know,
yeah.
like
the, yeah,
he's saying
was,
he right. I mean,
the
but
children
I,
of Reagan. The children,
yeah,
of
I think he was trying to tie
Scott?
Him tie him. Tie himself to the Reagan legacy.
Sherrod, what are your thoughts on this?
You know, just in watching the whole thing, what kind of saddens me is that there doesn't seem to be any place for moderation in any of the parties. Mm-hmm. And that saddens me. I mean, you see mm-hmm. the Republican Party moving mm-hmm. aggressively to the right. You see the Democratic Party moving aggressively to the left. Mm-hmm. Where do those individuals who are moderate and believe in respecting the views of others, where do we fit in this new paradigm of
well,
politics?
Well, they come out of the woodworks after the conventions.
Yeah.
And everybody, there's that rush to the center to see
right,
how we're going
right.
to do it.
That's a good
Listen,
point.
Sherrod Halliburton, thank you very much. Judy Sedgman, thank you very much. Eric Hodges, we thank you all for being with us. And again, if you've watched the entire broadcast, we thank all of our guests. Again, our thanks to being so welcomed here at MeTV in Bradenton, Florida. It's great to have you with us. Again, our thanks to Charles Clapsaddle and Fritz Goldman and everybody back in Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Bradenton, Florida.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a four-diamond hotel experience with a convenient location?
It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv.
8 years ago, there were barely more than 400,000 television homes in the entire country. By 1952, the 400,000 had grown to 18,700,000. By August 13th of 1956, there will be 36,800,000 homes in the United States equipped with television.
For more historic clips, go to museum.tv.